The next case is 95-1803, State of Ohio, Appeal of the Cincinnati Post versus the City of Cincinnati. Mr. Marburger.
Boy, you're not a big kid.
It's the same as you. Took some water or something.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm David Marburger representing. Related to Cincinnati Post, we would like to reserve 7 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Okay, you need to watch your time closely.
On March 19, 1996, in Hamilton County, it was a rainy and cold day, and it happened to be primary election day. And on that day, there was a heavier voter turnout than in any previous primary election in the past 20 years. And the voters were there to vote on what is ultimately the subject matter of this lawsuit, and that is whether the county, in cooperation with the City of Cincinnati, should raise and spend over $540 million in public money to build two new stadiums for the Cincinnati professional football team and the Cincinnati professional baseball team.
And they decided by a vote to do that.
The public decided by a vote to approve that.
Does that make this all moot?
It doesn't make it moot in any respect whatsoever, Justice Douglas, because the issue here is whether the City of Cincinnati's council, despite the enormity of public interest in this issue, can discuss these proposals that ultimately were voted on by the public while barring the public from hearing firsthand any of that discussion. And whether the City Council can do that by merely dividing itself into many sub-quorum sessions, repetitive in content, where ultimately a majority of council is engaged in the discussion and can do so not only by excluding the public, but by telling the press and the public that the Sunshine Law of the State of Ohio and the Sunshine Provisions of the Charter enacted by the people of Cincinnati do not prevent them from doing so. And this court should rule that those sunshine provisions do prevent those kinds of back-to-back seriatim sessions designed to get around the law.
I think I read that there was some evidence that one reason these individual sessions, so-called information sessions, were held was because it was difficult to get the council members together. Were there efforts to get? It seems to me it might have been easier to have just a couple meetings of all members of council and given this information. Do we know in the record why that wasn't done, or was it just a matter of convenience?
It wasn't just a matter of convenience, although the mayor posited that as the justification. But in fact, when a member of council desired to attend one of these sessions and if doing so would create a majority, the member of council would say, no, you can't attend that session. If it was a matter of convenience, merely convenience, then why was it that whenever a majority of council would have appeared at the same place at the same time, the city manager said, I'm sorry, you've got to go.
How close were these informational meetings held to the general session of council?
Well, on the first set of sessions was held the morning of Wednesday, June 21st, when that day, in the afternoon, council was having its regular session as an entire body. And in fact, none of the discussion held that morning, that Wednesday morning, was brought up during the regular session, which the public is included that afternoon.
My understanding is that it was not just information, or there was a question back, it was give and take, it was comment between council members and
I think that's undisputed. The numerous members of council testified under their oath that there was give and take and exchange of views and commentary all the way through.
Council, uh,
your theory is that there was a, that a prime motivation of the whole setup of these meetings was to avoid the requirements of including the public or representatives of the public.
Yes.
The press. How far, what we get is right, how far do we go? I assume you don't mean to prohibit one-on-ones mayor and council members or a couple of members of council who have concern about some issue and they go visit the mayor or other city officials or a couple of councilmen to get together, discuss, I'm concerned about this issue leaning this way. We think can we round up some support? Where do you draw those lines?
There are a number of ways to analyze these situations, and we suggest this way. Where we can start with this case in and of itself, where the city manager, although he was reluctant to do so, eventually admitted that the reason he set these up was to get around the Sunshine Law, and that was specifically at pages 52, 53, 54, and 55 of his testimony, in which he said, I said to him, and so the reason you had less than a majority in your offices was because if you had a majority and you still excluded the public, you were concerned that that would be a violation, and he said yes. Now here you have what amounts to, a direct admission that he was trying to get around the Sunshine Law, but you wouldn't need a direct admission, a smoking gun, in order to rule that sessions like these...
But do you think you go so far as to prohibit mayors or governors or what have you going one-on-one with legislators or getting two or three people who seem to be like-minded and are causing you a problem on a particular issue and have come to Jesus talk about it? Where you all are on this issue, and why are you giving me fits on this issue? The kinds of things that seem to me to need to be done to make a legislative body ever arrive at a consensus. It seems to me, whether it's a council or what kind of a legislative, they don't just all independently get in their cars and come to the meetings and never discuss anything with each other or with some member of the administration before they begin to formulate where they think they want to go.
I understand. We aren't advocating here at any point in the case that anybody be prohibited from doing any kind of discussion. The issue is whether the public has to be, whether there's authority to bar the public from those discussions, not whether they can have the discussions. We suggest that this be the analysis.
My question assumes that in the formative stages, not every councilman, not every legislator just automatically thinks brilliant thoughts about every issue without some nurturing some input, some give and take back and forth with peers or with people who have other information that's going to help them form that opinion. And in those early stages, is your view that the press has a right to be there in those early discussions where you're forming up your thoughts, you're trying to get an idea to be able to report on that when it's an unpolished idea, when it's maybe not a very good idea, if it's a foolish idea.
Well, I apologize for not getting to this right more directly than I have. This is the analysis that we suggest the court adopt, and we suggest this because we derive this analysis from the law itself, the statute itself, or from the charter itself, and that do this. A, is it prearranged? Are these sessions prearranged, pre-scheduled? B, are they repetitive in content? That is, are you meeting with enough people and saying the same things over and over again to members of the public body? And C, are they discussing public business in that repetitive way, the same exact thing?
But doesn't there have to be, or maybe you're going to give the D. I should
say, and ultimately, the member, the people who are having these discussions have to amount to a majority of the public body, and that these discussions would have to occur close enough in time so as to fairly represent a continuum of the same discussion by the same public body.
But isn't there another requirement that the statute contains, and it says to conduct all deliberations on official business? Were they really deliberating official business, or were they simply, as Justice Pfeiffer was questioning you about, receiving information so that they could in a more informed way deliberate about this matter?
The mention of deliberations that you're referring to, Justice Resnick, is in the preamble to the Sunshine Law. It's not actually the same as the rest of the provisions in the Sunshine Law, which are hard and fast requirements. The hard and fast requirements are that when there is a pre-arranged discussion, and the operative word is discussion of public business by a majority of the members of a public body, that those pre-arranged discussions have to be open to the public or to those who choose to attend. Now, what is a discussion? Now, why does the General Assembly, first of all, tell us that? The General Assembly said that discussions are open to the public so that the public can see what it is, what information is being considered by the public body when it's assembling in its official capacity. What information is under consideration? Now, it would certainly be an odd law that if the mayor, who is the head of council in Cincinnati, if the mayor was unilaterally imparting information to council members about legislation the mayor had an opinion about or had investigated or had researched, and to say that, well, when there's this unilateral imparting of information to the council, you can exclude the public, but if someone chirps up and reacts to what the mayor says, well, then you can't exclude the public. I'm discussing something with you now, and really, I'm the only one talking. But that's okay, because that's what the law is designed to allow. The imparting of information to a public body without excluding the public from knowing what it is the body is considering. And so the operative word is not deliberation, but discussion. What's at stake in this case, really, is whether the Sunshine Law of the State of Ohio and the Sunshine Provision of the Charter enacted by the people of Cincinnati are dead or alive, whether they are real or just an illusion. And they are not real. They are just an illusion if public bodies are free to merely divide themselves in back-to-back sessions of less than majority, and have repeat discussions until a full majority has had the same discussion and thereby exclude the public. That would mean that all discussions of public business, no matter what the topic or subject matter, can be done outside of public ears.
Mr. Marburger, an advisory opinion may be desirable in this situation, but what is it that your client would have happened? I guess the meetings, if they're declared to be public meetings, and there has to be a record prepared, which there was not apparently, the record would then be public, and that would be available to whoever wants it, including a newspaper who might wish to inform the public. I mean, obviously it's not going to affect the election, but I take it that their interest is in informing the public if they decide it's worthy discussion or whatever regarding the discussions that occurred among the council members, so that the public may have knowledge about the thought process. Is that why this is not
correct, Chief Justice Moyer? It's to learn what ultimately is behind that measure which the voters ultimately then approve. What was the rationale behind it? What were the alternatives considered and rejected? What were the pros and cons, as far as the elected representatives were concerned, of the various proposals that were being bannered about under the deadline set by the Cincinnati Bengals? And numerous members of council and their aides who attended these back-to-back sessions took notes, and those notes have been preserved. It would certainly be possible, if we were to get a writ, we would hope that the members of council would refer their notes and create minutes that would describe these discussions in some official way so that the paper could A, report on them, and B, so that the public can B, can be enlightened about.
So if you win, do you think you have a right to those notes that individual members of the council took while they were in the room?
Well, they gave us the notes. We already have them.
Okay. But they did.
Pardon me?
If they did, if members of council attended private meetings with the mayor, took notes, and didn't give them to you, but you knew they had them. If you win here, do you have a right to discovery of those notes?
If the Cincinnati Post were fortunate enough to get it right here, it really wouldn't have any effect in our judgment, depending on what the court would write. But it really wouldn't have, it wouldn't speak to the issue of whether notes taken in a one-on-one conversation between a council member and the mayor of a public record.
So what's the next step then?
Well, I think that's, frankly, I think that's a very different issue. And I happen to have strong opinions about that issue, but I don't think that it particularly, and I'm happy to discuss it, but I don't think this case presents those issues.
Is it necessary for you, or can you distinguish the third paragraph from the syllabus of Barnes?
Well, Justice Douglas, I'm embarrassed to say, and I litigated that case for the plaintiff, I don't remember what paragraph 3 of the syllabus says.
Fine, let me help you. As used in Section 28 of the City Charter of the City of Cleveland, a meeting of the City Council or any of its committees means any assemblage of the City Council or its committees where a majority of members constituting the body are in attendance and the gathering is arranged for the purpose of discussing public business. Seems like it's a condition precedent that there be a majority.
Well, we're asking the court to recognize that there was a de facto majority here. That in fact, if any city, whether it be City Council of Cleveland or City Council of Cincinnati, is authorized by law to avoid this requirement of the syllabus by breaking themselves up into back-to-back sessions, barring a majority from attending, even if a majority desired to attend, that would defeat not only the syllabus, it would defeat the charter, it would defeat the Sunshine Law, it would make them deadlocked.
Wait a minute, that's not what that says, Mr. Marburger. Can't you just as easily read that where there is not a majority constituting the body in attendance, then it is not a meeting?
Sure, you could read that, but in this circumstances, under the totality of these circumstances, it was a constructive de facto meeting.
Well, we aren't talking about de facto, we're talking about de jure. You know that. We're talking about the law. The law says that if you've got, as we used to have, 9 members on City Council, 5 of us should not be in the room at the same time talking about public business.
If you're barring from the public from that.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, the city manager regularly did that, and I don't know that I was ever comfortable with it. I only know that whenever I'd walk down the hall and he asked me to come in and there were 4 other councilmen in the room, I wouldn't go in. But it never occurred to me that they were violating the law.
Well, even if you happened in, they may not be violating the law if it's not prearranged. The key words is that it be prearranged. Here, what you had prearranged was a series of back-to-back sessions admitted by the city manager to be done.
That's the way
so to violate
that's
them.
The way he always schedules them. That's the way every city manager schedules them, thinking they've been in compliance with the Sunshine Law and our charter. And I just guess I always thought that we were, so long as you didn't have 5 of us in the room at the same time. I'm not sure that's a very good law, but isn't that what it says?
That's a literal reading of the law, but when we can apply the law to actual facts, and when we are asked to construe the law, and the court is asked to construe the law, it ought not to construe the law, as this court has said repeatedly in the past, so as to defeat its legislative purpose.
And how broad does our order go? Prohibit any legislative body from attending any prearranged meeting where any public business might be discussed regardless of the number of attendees. That's really the syllabus.
That's really not what we're asking for, though, Justice Douglas. What we're asking for would be a ruling that says, in effect, this, that where a series of sessions are prearranged, where the content of those sessions is repetitive, that is, an item of public business is being discussed in a repetitive way, with ultimately a majority of the members of the public body are discussing the same thing in seriatim fashion, and where these sessions are close enough in time to reasonably fairly represent a continuum of the same discussion by this majority, then that is the same as a meeting, whether it be under this syllabus in the Plain Dealer case, or whether it be under the charter of Cincinnati, or whether it be under the Sunshine.
Maybe if you rule that, you can maybe arrange to get us into the editorial boards while they're making these decisions, too.
Well, if they enacted laws and could force people to pay tax money, I'd say sure.
Does the activity, in your view, to be public and to be de facto constructive, does it have to be directed at some action of council or not? In other words, if the mayor or the city manager, if there was a disaster in Cincinnati, and the members of council were interested in having information about it, not because they had to do something about it, but they just simply wanted to know what happened. And the city manager set up a series of meetings with them to give them just information. But they were prearranged, and for some reason you get on the record that, well, we didn't want to have a majority. Not because we were going to take some action at some point, but for some reason, got bad witnesses. Either we didn't want to have a majority. Is that different in your mind than the situation we have here, where some action of council was anticipated ultimately from the information they had received?
While it is different in my mind, it is different in my mind only in terms of degree, not in terms of result. That if the issue in your scenario, Chief Justice Moyer, would be, is the subject matter of the prearranged discussions a matter of public business? If indeed it's a matter of public business, in our view, it does not matter whether only one person is doing the speaking or more than one. The Sunshine Law and the Cincinnati Charter are not designed to create an audience for a local version of Crossfire. What they're designed to do is to allow the public to learn firsthand what it is, what information of public business is being considered by the body. Let's suppose we change your hypothetical and we say that the mayor comes in and says, look, we found a big shortfall in the city treasury, but let's not tell anybody about it. And so no action is taken. Nobody asks questions. Nobody makes comments. But the mayor has provided information to the public body that is very, very important to public business.
Suppose, and I realize the rules of the legislature are different, and this is an example of some emergency. The governor pulls in a bunch of folks and says, the savings and loan industry in this state is about to collapse. We get some tough talk that needs to go on here, but for a few moments until we figure out what to do, we don't want to start runs on the banks. So I'm going to pull you in a group at a time to discuss that. Stay under the numbers. And I can't think of an appropriate hypothetical for America.
I understand, and I agree that creates a problem, but I think we have to follow the law in that circumstance. If the law is...
Well, but the, as Justice Douglas pointed out, the law seems to be, and if you're the mayor or the city manager trying to figure out how to do that, the law would seem to be at this point, you can do it if you stay under a majority in each meeting.
If that's the case, Justice Piper, then every single item of public business, whether discussed today or discussed at any time in the future, can be done in a way so as to exclude the public and defeat the statutes, the Sunshine statutes, whether they be in charters or revised code. If that's the case, anybody can do it very simply, especially with a smaller public body, something smaller than 9 members of council. And if that's the case, then the statutes, if that's going to be the ruling, if that were to be the ruling, then the statutes really don't mean anything anymore. And all you really do get to see is votes. Because it doesn't take anything to schedule seriatim sessions of three people.
Is the word or the term prearranged a necessary part of your proposed syllabus?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so a city manager at the conclusion of the council meeting could go to three council members and say, can I see you in my office before you leave? That'd be okay.
I think probably yes. Where it's more or less
so
spontaneous.
So aren't we just inviting subterfuge? Aren't we in a position where we're forcing people to say, oh, this wasn't prearranged, it was spontaneous? There'd be no way for us to prove it. If you're prepared to accept prearranged under these set of circumstances, you know, it gets closer for me. But if the city manager comes up to you after a council meeting and says, well, three of you stop in before you go to lunch, and says, you, Douglas Cook, and Denise, will you stop in? When you stop into the office, that's okay.
I think that could be a harder case if it was done like this. Let's say there are seven council members, and the city manager says to the first three, how about stopping into my office? As soon as he's done talking with those three, he says to the next three, how about stopping in my office? And they repeat exactly the same discussion. And then I think it's a more difficult case to call.
But it's not prearranged.
The issue would be, is it prearranged?
Okay.
Is this really a prearrangement?
Are you willing
to
accept that prearranged is a condition precedent to violation?
That's our strongly held view, and we held that view because that is both in the syllabus of the Barnes case, as it construes a charter provision similar to Cincinnati's charter, and it's also a condition precedent in the Sunshine Law. I mean, that's the key to public meetings. It's got to be a prearranged discussion.
What about the call from the mayor or the city manager or whatever? Picks up the phone, systematically goes down through the members' council. We've got a tough issue coming up. Here's the dope. Here's my point of view. Here's why I think you should support it. Here's what I'm going to do to you if you don't support it. Pretty interesting reading, maybe important to read. Violation of law.
I think that that's going to depend on what the issue is going to be. Is that a prearranged discussion of public business? So, A, is it public business? I assume
the mayor's got a list. He's got a list of the home phone numbers of the council members. And he systematically goes down through them and leans on them hard.
And I think the issue is going to be to what extent are those seriatim discussions prearranged? And I think that...
Well, they weren't prearranged as far as the councilman's concerned. I mean, he or she didn't know the phone call was coming. He or she didn't particularly enjoy the phone conversation that took place. But the mayor had the list and knew exactly what he or she was trying
to do. I think one of the key things in your hypothetical is that council doesn't know what's coming. It's council's the public body. In other words,
that's what controls. If the participants, the members, the legislative body, know it's prearranged.
Participate in the prearrangement or acquiesce to the schedule.
It's what they know, not what the person calling the meeting knows in terms of the prearrangement.
Depending on who that person is, that's right. I mean, if it's the head council, that might be different. But if it is, in Cleveland, for example, they have a different structure of government than Cincinnati. The mayor of Cleveland is not a member of council, and Cincinnati the mayor is. So if it was a Cleveland mayor setting it up that way, I think that that's a different fact situation than if the Cincinnati mayor was doing it, because Cincinnati mayor is the head of council.
Thank you, Mr. Marburger. Mr. Caden.
Thank you, support council. Almost good afternoon. My name is Carl Caden. I'm the deputy city solicitor for the city of Cincinnati, and I represent the city's interests herein. I think the court has a good grasp of the path upon which it will tread, where it will go. Post assertions in this case are adopted as law. we might as well displace the city solicitors, the legal counsel's role in the arms of government, because this court will be resolving any and all issues which relate to the application of the Sunshine Law, as my esteemed opposition relates
why
to the court.
But why shouldn't all city business be done in the public domain? Isn't sunshine the best disinfectant?
Your Honor, the judgment, the subjective judgment as to, or the value judgment as to whether or not all public business is best conducted before the public eye is one which is not mine to say. I think the General Assembly has adequately handled that or adequately addressed that in the language of the law that is Ohio law. 121.22 says what business is to be conducted, when, how it's to occur. I think in a perfect world, it'd be wonderful if we could all, if we had 100% voting in public, if everyone was as interested in the workings of government as we are, if everyone was as concerned with what happens as we are. That's just not the way it is.
But you have exceptions for those major things like personnel matters, acquisition of property, discussing lawsuits. Those can be done outside of the public domain. When you're going to talk about committing $500 million of tax money to a particular enterprise within the city, isn't that the public's business?
That gives me 2 points. First of all, recall here that this is a county tax proposal, Hamilton County tax levy, Hamilton County issue. The city leases the stadium from the county and then subleases it to the tenants. The city is involved as a peripheral matter. Therefore, the county was the negotiating agency with the sports franchises in this case. When we classify these as informational briefings or informational sessions, that's exactly what they were designed to do, designed so the manager could tell his council members what's going on now before there's a press conference somewhere else and they read about it and then nobody seems to know what's going on. I think we're all familiar with that kind of a scenario. That's what went on here. The city determination on the ultimate determination was on the final outcome of the county's negotiations with the teams. That's what ultimately was voted on. That is what ended up on the ballot on May 19th. And it could have happened without the city's consent, I suppose.
Didn't the council did eventually meet in an open session and made an agreement with the county, didn't it?
Yes, sir.
So these meetings were designed to give council members the information upon which they would make an ultimate decision, weren't they?
Under the city manager form of government, the city manager was responsible for, I guess, point negotiations or point discussions with the county as to how the transfer would occur or the things that would have to happen if, in fact, the county would build two stadia for these sports franchises. The manager's responsibility is to keep his clients, his bosses, informed as to what's going on.
But I guess if there's an ultimate decision to be made by a vote of council, why doesn't that information occur in a public meeting? Why not?
It certainly could, but that's not what the law provides, and I think that's really where we go with this case. What isn't public business?
Council indicated that someone in authority said they did this to get around the open meeting.
Well,
is that true?
That's a glass half empty, half full, sir.
All I want to know is if council was misleading us when he said that.
The council's characterization of getting around the Sunshine Law, I think, is not accurate. I think it is. The depositions reflect that there was a mindfulness of the Sunshine Law, and a wish not to violate that law. That is, the manager testified, and I think some of the members of council directly testified.
Not to violate the law.
They do not want to violate the Sunshine Law. That is why they said we would not have gone in there in a majority group. For fear that we would violate the Sunshine Law.
And were these prearranged less than majority?
The manager schedules the meetings. That is also, I think, a representation that is less than accurate. The city council did not subdivide itself or divide itself into sub-quora. The manager scheduled these briefings through his staff, and there were less than a majority present.
And it was done on purpose. The number was determined by the city manager?
The number was determined by the city manager. The purpose was to convey the information. Please.
He called the meetings?
He himself.
He set the agenda?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I think that's fair to say. But
these matters came up for vote before city council. How much actual discussion preceded the vote, and how much public discussion preceded the vote?
Well, the night of the special session, I'm sorry, I was not there at that time. I am given to understand that there was a great deal of it. I think the meeting started in the evening, and it lasted until about approximately midnight or shortly after midnight. So
if we let this practice stand, what is to prevent this from becoming the standard method of operation, where anytime sensitive issues are discussed, the city manager does them in what we call ad seriatim fashion, and then all that happens in the public meeting is a simple vote? What's to prevent that from becoming the standard practice?
Well, I think, first, ma'am, I believe that this practice, as we say, it is widespread, but not necessarily in this particular form. Every time a legislator caucuses or goes to another legislator, could go in serial fashion, one and repetitively, and in a prearranged mode to each and every other member of the body, saying the same thing as just Mr. Justice Piper indicated. This is what I think is coming up, and this is where I think we stand on this, and I'd like your support. That's prearranged. There's a repetitive nature there. That's public business, certainly. As I said, everything's public business. Everything's prearranged as well, I suppose. And it's certainly close enough in time. That meets the de facto meeting standards. There's a huge danger in that. I think what the real answer to your question, ma'am, is that if that in fact occurs, if there is a level of secretiveness about government that is not tolerable, the remedy is change the charter or change Ohio law. I don't see any hesitancy on the part of either the General Assembly or on the part of my city council to change the law to conform to the needs, the wishes of the people. That is, I think, the answer rather than wandering down a path where...
Don't you agree with me that the purpose of the Sunshine Law is to try to keep discussions of public business public and open to the public?
That may be the purpose, but I think it is adequately defined as that this is by majority of the members. I think that's where the rubber hits the road. That's where the reality of government business.
So by always keeping it less than the majority, you can get around it. Is that the answer?
Well, I would say that if there is less than a majority, then the law is not implicated. I wish to emphasize that I think people would change that in a heartbeat if they saw that something was going on that they thought was fishy, particularly in Cincinnati. I think this case is as much about the right of Ohioans under the Constitution of this state to govern themselves as it is about the discussion of public business or the discussion of public records. Really, this case, the charter of the city, it's apparent in the deference that I think that charter, that document is due, makes a great distinction between the term proceedings and meetings. And if we adhere to that literally,
they weren't trying to get around the Sunshine Law, which is what you seem to be asserting. Why would this one council member refuse admittance?
I think there was a fear that a presence of more than a majority in the room could be classified, or would be classified by someone as a Sunshine Law violation, and it would create this kind of controversy.
Isn't the issue, perhaps, that give the benefit of the doubt to city manager and the council members? They were attempting to comply with their understanding of the open meeting law. And the challenge for us is to decide whether the law is to be applied literally, or whether a council or a legislative body can meet in prearranged meetings in a small majority or in small groups, less than a majority, for the purpose of discussing business of the city, so that they do not have to discuss it in public. Isn't that what we have to decide, is whether we apply the law literally? That if you apply it literally, you could have, as you say, you could have every meeting of council could be in small groups, and then they meet on Tuesday nights, and they come in and cast their votes. No deliberation, no discussion. Public has no idea why they voted the way they did. I mean, if you apply it literally, sure, they didn't violate it unless we say that's a subterfuge. And that's the issue, and for us to decide the legal issue.
Yes, sir, I completely agree. That's the whole point here. You know, that could happen. There could be this subterfuge mentality that goes on. I don't think anybody would stand for it. But I think if you looked at almost any law of this state, there are ways to get around it. I think it's unfair to classify it as the conduct of compliance or attempts to comply with as efforts to get around the law.
Well, I guess this gives us about as clear a case, it seems to me, as we could have. In which members of a legislative body appear to comply with the letter of the law by violating its spirit.
Well, I think the distinction, if I may, sir, the distinction would be that in this case, the public body itself made no decisions. In the Michigan case cited by a relator, the public body itself made a subdivision. Not so here. The city manager said, I'll tell you.
Well, see, that's what we have to decide. It seems to me that the intention of the open meetings law is that that the public's business, with some exceptions, is to be done in public. And here, it wasn't. I mean, the votes were taken, and maybe there was a lot of discussion at the council meeting, but there was a good bit of discussion that occurred with the public not being there. I guess that's the question we have to decide. What's the intent, what's the purpose of the open meetings law?
Yeah. And so that occurs, I think, on a daily basis all across the state, all across the country, and it's no more nefarious than it was in this case.
Oh, I'm not suggesting it's nefarious. I'm just saying that, sure, it's much easier to have these discussions without reporters there or the public there. It's much easier.
Fishbowl.
But the question is that the policy of the open meetings law, because that's the issue.
The policy implications notwithstanding, I think that's the law. That's the way the General Assembly has defined it. That's the way it's been laid down, set forth, and that's the way the law is. But that's just one. There's an issue here as to the charter, and this court has ruled in past cases construing this issue that charter provisions prevail exclusively. And in this case, there's a discussion in Cincinnati's charter about meetings and proceedings, and it's our position that at the time the charter was, that provision was adopted, that the people of the city of Cincinnati determined that what they wanted to see was they wanted to know who voted how. I think that's probably the way it is in the General Assembly as well. I think it's consistent across the face of it.
Council, I guess we're all struggling with this, and we have a bigger concern. Really isn't what happened here, because with this much money on the line, I would have guessed, and apparently it is so, since the newspapers already have the notes of some of the councilmen attending, probably some of the folks have walked out of those meetings, immediately discussed what went on inside the room with members of the press, so that there weren't many secrets kept about those particular meetings. And I would also guess that in a city the size of Cincinnati, if business were conducted as a matter of course this way on every issue, it wouldn't be long until that became a hot political issue. But you don't have to move very far up the road. I don't recall whether it's Mason or one of the little municipalities where we had a case not long ago in which
Oxford. Yeah.
In which the issue was that council routinely had a private meeting and came out and it was slam dang, thank you, ma'am, and there was no, just as Justice Stratton alluded to, the public had no real window on why things were really happening, or what the motivation of various members of council might have been, or their thinking might have been on the issues of the day, and that was happening, not occasionally, but it would have been commonplace for a long time.
So your concern is justified, it's well placed, there's no question about that, but I think really what we're talking about is the ability of people to govern themselves. They decide, the people ultimately decide how we are to govern them in every case. And an ideal world. I think this is where the theory of de facto meetings and the theories of what amounts to something that ought to be disclosed really runs into the reality of, okay, how are we going to accomplish this and where do we go down the road? Because there's no end. There will be no end to this court's determination of what amounts to public business. There will be no end to this court's determination of deliberations. There will be no end to when is a majority been attained and when not, and what's a quorum and has been a subdivision. All these things will just come surging into this courtroom. And what I would suggest to this court is that the law has been defined, and since it is the obligation of those who are governing to govern well, that they have the obligation to take whatever steps that they see necessary to accomplish that means. Legitimate steps to accomplish those means. If the people do not like that, the people can change that.
I don't want to carry this on any longer, but I'm not sure I understand your parade of horribles about all the cases coming. If we write what the Cincinnati Post wants us to write in terms of syllabus, then that just ended up. Everything is the public's business, and the public has the right to be there. Maybe that just ends all the case.
No, I don't think it does at all, because I think if that is the ruling, then I think the Sunshine Law is probably unconstitutional as it would apply to those individuals who are elected or selected to govern, because I don't see how they're going to fulfill their obligation to their constituents and to the government to help their people petition for redress of grievances, to communicate, to express themselves. I think that's a huge issue that will land that law squarely in the United States Supreme Court. If this court doesn't jump in.
Do you think the people referred to, the people really would want their city council to function this way regularly on a regular basis? I'm taking you at face value. You said the people don't, they've spoken, they've adopted a charter and a statute. But do you think they really would want?
That's a question of the times, I think, now. The people would probably appreciate being exposed to less of the conflict, perhaps.
Well, I agree with that.
I will say
I'm not sure we changed city charters
like
based on it, but I agree with that.
I'm very happy with my work, but that they would be happy to do that. I think perhaps in another era, or another time, if legislating occurred in a different way, if there wasn't perhaps so much an emphasis on speaking to the camera, then I think it may be different. And that's fine, but I'm a big public trust kind of a guy. I think that's where we go back with this, is the public trust. And if this is wrong, then the law needs to be changed by the people who elect the legislators, the people who create the Constitution and the Charter, not by us. I would ask that this court deny the writ and send this case back.
Thank you, Mr. Caden. Mr. Marburger, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds, see what you can do with it.
Thank you. The city's position here is that the city officials, not this court, are the final arbiter on how you interpret the law. And that if the people don't like the way the city officials have interpreted the people's laws, the people have to petition to change it, basically excising this court from any role in interpreting law.
Well, but we do that sometimes. We apply just the plain letter of the law. I try to do it quite a bit, frankly. And if we do that here, they're okay, aren't they? They complied with the law. They didn't break the law. They complied with the law. They had meetings of members of council, less than a majority. If the people of Cincinnati don't like that, don't want their council to do all this talking about their ballot issues behind closed doors, they can sure change the charter, can't they?
I suppose that's an option available to them. If they really wanted to comply with the law, Chief Justice Moyer, they would have had these discussions in their open regular sessions on Wednesday, June 21st, instead of in the morning with these back-to-back facades. The city manager, again, question, and so the reason that you had less than a majority in your offices was because if you had a majority and you still excluded the public, you were concerned that that would be a violation? Yes. He wasn't trying to comply with the law. What he was trying to do was to create an artifice to have public business discussed outside of public view and still be able to say, well, the Sunshine Law doesn't prevent that.
That's not an effort to comply with the law. That's an effort to break the law and being able to say you've complied with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session. Awesome.